Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4, for spring semester 2019. Lecture 14, delivered on March 20, 2019. The title of this lecture is Bonds.
Today, bonds. A lot of what I'm saying here is terminology, definitions, and explanations. And then on Monday, I'll do math on this topic. And like I said, the math is not hard as long as you remember what's what and key the numbers in right. It's almost like no-brainer compared to what it used to be years ago. You might even see where that how it would have been difficult. But bonds in general, bond is actually kind of a generic term for a debt instrument. Technically, I could be talking about something that's a note, and you might hear me say, this bond. It's sort of like any debt instrument we call a bond. Now, remember, technically, a bill is less than a year. A note is between 1 and 7, 1 and 10, or even 1 and 15 now. And a bond is something long, like a 20 or 30 year. First things first on it. Whenever I talk about bonds, when I say the issuer or the seller, that's the borrower. So you, sir, are a corporation that needs to borrow $1 million. Was that actually liquid in there? Okay. No, I was going to say if it's coffee, save it. I am the lender. You are going to sell me a bond. You want to borrow money from me for 20 years. So you're going to sell me a bond, and the price will be $1 million? Yeah, that's, so I'm the buyer, the investor, the bond holder, and you are the issuer, the writer of it, the borrower. Now, you'll hear me use different terms. I might say debt paper. That's just kind of like a, like a more professional thing that we're, or the lingo that we would use. All right, you're going to issue some debt paper to me. Okay, now, the debt instrument itself, if I don't say anything else, and I don't think I will in this class, the face value, what you are borrowing is a multiple of $1,000. The future value, the face value, FV, is always $1,000. So if you borrowed $1 million, that would mean that you're actually issuing 1,000 bonds, okay? But we always break it down to one bond with a face value of $1,000. That's how we always do it. So always remember, FV in your calculator is $1,000. Now, the next thing is, what's the interest rate that you're going to pay? That's called the coupon. Now, the coupon is going to be stated as a percent. Let's say 8%. That is 8% of the face value. So you, in other words, you're going to borrow from me $1,000 with a coupon of 8%. That means that that is $80 a year that you pay me. Now, government and corporate debt does not work like consumer debt. With consumer debt, your payment is paying your interest for the month and a little bit of your principal every month. With corporate and government debt, all that's being paid through the life of the bond is the interest. And at the end, the face value, what you borrowed, is paid back. So in other words, with corporate and government debt, all you do is service the debt during the life of the bond. With consumer debt, you are amortizing the principal through the life. Through the life. So, in other words, let's say that this has a term of 20 years or a maturity 20 years out. So, in fact, let's do this one. NFLX, 6.8%, 2033. Late. Here's what's going to happen. 2019 on a timeline, 2020, 2021. We'll do a break here, and then we'll come out here to 2032, 2033. Every year during the life of this instrument, this is a 20-year debt instrument, the company's going to pay $68 per bond. That's the coupon. And then in 2032, it'll pay $68. And then in 2033, it will make one last payment of the coupon, and it will pay off the principal. $1,000. That's how debt instruments work. That's how corporate and government work. Okay? They just service. And then at the end. Now, I'm not even going to get into that. That's just how we do this. And I want to mention in a minute some commercial paper and things like that, really short term, that doesn't work quite the same way. But by the way, in real life, in the real world, they would be making these payments in two parts per year. So this would actually be $34 every 6 months. So we have to take, and I'll show you how to do that. The first ones I'll do will be simple. Let's say it's every year they make their coupon payment. And then I'll show you it's not that hard to just make it so that it's every half year to do the calculations. But that's essentially, that's how corporate and government debt works. You're just going to get an interest payment every year over the life. That, by the way, one thing that I should point out, that's why we call bonds fixed income investments. Because, and these are those kinds of things that are ideal for older people, we would put their money into bonds because then every year they just get this coupon payment in the mail. So if I've got a couple that wants to put, they got $1 million. I could put that million into these, and every year they're just going to get a $68,000 check. Is that right? Yeah. Every 6 months they get a $34,000 check. They're fixed income investments. And they're good for corporations that want a reliable cash flow from their investments. They're not like stocks where you may or may not have a dividend. And if you have a dividend, it may or may not be paid. And you're relying a lot on the stock going up in price or something like that. Those are speculative. And you probably wouldn't want a lot of that in an older person's portfolio because it's not fixed in the income stream. These are completely predictable. What's going to go? Almost completely predictable. But you see, over the life of this, if I put them into this, I know what they're going to get every year, as long as the company doesn't go into bankruptcy or something like that. So keep that in mind, that this is why, as you get older, we try to move you toward these kinds of fixed income investments. We'll also move you toward a kind of stock that acts like a bond. It's called preferred stock. We'll put that into that. And also in that portfolio, we might have some old, reliable companies. Their price doesn't go anywhere, for the most part, but they pay a reliable big dividend. So in other words, the company doesn't plow back in to grow. It's already huge. And so those are the kinds of things that we call fixed income, because we know what's going to come in the future as far as cash flow goes. Of course, your return on those is going to be lower, because the greater the risk, the greater the expected return. But we're not trying to do that with these people. We're trying to get them away from risk and toward a lower expected return. So there's that. Now, I do want to bring up, of course, but there is some debt paper that has different rules in it. There's some very short-term paper. Like, for example, I showed you those Treasury bills. Treasury bills, you buy the Treasury bill for $980, and in a year you get $1,000. Those are called discount instruments, those very short ones. There's one in particular. It's a huge market, and it's for companies that want to borrow money for 30 days. It's working capital kind of money, and there is a large market for it. Companies that issue the paper and investors who buy the paper. It's called commercial paper. I want to show you how it works, and I'm going to pass how to do it by you, and then I'll come back and show you more formally later. So if you don't get it, why I'm doing what I'm doing, just get it in your notes, and then you'll see it will sink in. Remember, I try to do something in layers like this. So let's say that MSFT issues commercial paper. And let's say it's 30-day commercial paper for $980. What that means is that you give Microsoft $980 today, and 30 days later, you'll get $1,000 back. That's what it means. I'm not sure. Actually, I should put that more like at about 990. Okay, so now, the next thing is, what does the investor get as far as an annualized yield? Now, here's how you do it. And it doesn't matter how long the paper is. This would apply to 30, 60, 180, 2-year, 8-year, 1,000-year. The formula is the same. Watch how I do it. You're going to get back $1,000, so you make that the numerator. And you divide it by how much you're going to pay for it, $990. Now, the next thing that you do is you raise that to the 1 over the number of years. Now, in this case, the number of years would be 30 days divided by 365. It's always 1 over the number of years, whether there is a whole number of years or just a number of days. And then you minus one. Now watch how I thought I logged in here. Oh, I did. Now I want you to watch how I do this on the calculator in one set of strokes. And I've always encouraged you, don't try to get a number, then write it down, and then put it back in. In this case, just clearing the screen on a TI-83, I'm going to say, open parenthesis, 1,000 divided by the 990. And here's where you've got to watch it. Close those parentheses. Now you're going to raise to the power. Now you open parenthesis 1 divided by. Now you're going to open parenthesis again to tell the calculator, calculate 30 divided by 365. And then you close those parentheses. And then you close the final set of parentheses. And then you minus your 1. Whoa, 13%. you're not going to see commercial paper that. Yeah, I should have put about 998 on that, but there you go. Yeah.
Is that the yield percentage?
That's the annualized yield as a percent. That's the annualized. And this is what we always try to do. We try to make everything annualized so that we can compare all, you know, I can compare this to a 2 year, to a 20 year, to a 3 day, to a 180 day. They all are in exactly the same units. Annualized return. And that's why we do that one over the number of years. Like if this had been a 2 year paper, I'd have done 1/2. If it had been a half year paper, I would have done 1/0.5. If it had been a 10 year paper, 1/10. If it had been a 1 month paper, I would have done 1/112. It's always the number of years in that denominator. So just remember to just key it in like you see me do there. I raise it to the power, and I open the parentheses. I say, what's coming is an exponent. And then within that exponent, the denominator, I have to say, calculate that first. So I trap that in its own little parentheses. And don't forget to subtract 1 at the end, which I am endlessly forgetting to do. But that's way high. Commercial paper is issued by large creditworthy corporations. It's basically working capital management money. Even the government does this. They have 1 year treasury bills. This is just quick money for something that they need it for 30 days. And it's an enormous market. Both large corporations sell this paper to get some money, and there are just tons of investors who they don't have anything to do with money for 30 days, so they buy commercial paper. As a matter of fact, one of the corporations here in town, I know the people in the treasury department at the corporation, and they are constantly they get in these large amounts of money in these big blocks, and they don't have to pay the money for anything for a month or two. And so a lot of it, they just throw into commercial paper. They've got a broker who they'll just say, we've got $800,000 today. Can you take it into some paper for us? And they know, yeah, that's commercial paper. And they just put it in there. 30 days later, it pops out the other end with a little bit of extra money in it. As a matter of fact, and I'll tell you about this. You don't need to write this down yet. If you have a good bank account and you've got enough money to do it, you can have your money in what's called a sweep, where every night, your business puts money in or you put money in and you don't need it until the next morning. That money, once the day has ended, they sweep that money into these massive liquidity markets to add liquidity to the global flow of money. And then in the morning, they sweep it back out and put it back into your account. So every day for maybe about 16, 14 hours, for small companies, for well-to-do people, that money is earning money in the global market and adding liquidity to that market because there's this money out there ready to be lent on commercial paper, currency stuff, whatever. But I'll talk about that a little later. It's kind of a fascinating market that a lot of small businesses have figured out that, you know, if you're a retail business open from, let's say, 8 until 5, well, at 5, you take your money to the bank and put it in there, and you can either just let it sit there earning nothing, or you can have it in a sweep where it earns something when you don't need it. And then in the morning when you come in to get your money for the day to put in the cash registers, it's there for you back in there. A caution about commercial paper. It is large creditworthy corporations, very safe investment. Obviously, you're not going to make a lot on it. The high liquidity, it's gone for only 30 days. It's been around for many, many years. And we've always believed it was really safe stuff. And then came Enron. Enron was a high-flying, highly respected, very safe company. So we thought. Turned out the executives were lying through their teeth on the financial statement. The company was in severe trouble, mainly because the executives were siphoning money out of the company and putting it in their own personal accounts in offshore. No one knew it. Well, the whole pyramid was going to fall apart within about 2 weeks. The executives knew they were going to have to get out of town. So what did they do? They issued a pile of commercial paper. Oh, you know, it's just commercial paper. Sure, we'll lend you, you know, $30 million on 30 days paper. And of course, a few weeks later, all hell broke loose. The proverbial ship hit the fan. And that paper went belly up. So suddenly the market was rattled because what we had thought was an extremely safe investment was not so safe. So all the companies that were good players paid the price. You couldn't get it for $9.90. I mean, companies were, well, we're going to get $990. No, their investors are getting a little worried here. You might get $980, $975. But the times of the real tight between the face and the sell, that's over. And that went on for a lot of years because the markets got skittish. There was more risk than they had imagined. The market's a lot better now. There haven't been any real scandals. There have been a couple of belly-ups, but that's normal. So anyway, that gives you an idea that it is considered very, very safe. However, let's hope we never cross into the territory of an Enron-type scandal again. Okay, now. Next thing on the agenda. This is a terminology. I think, if my count's right, you get a total of 12 new terms in this lecture alone. So get these down, and then I'm going to just use them after I've explained each of them to you. The first thing is that let's say I want, you, madam, want to issue a bond, okay? Okay, so now you want to borrow, let's say, $20 million, which would mean that you're going to issue technically 200,000 bonds? Okay, something like that. Okay, each one with a face value of $1,000. Okay, so now, that means that you want to borrow from someone or someone's $20 million. Now, you are going to be the issuer, the borrower, the seller of the paper. Now, you could go and ask, hey, could you lend me $20 million? I'll give you a piece of paper for it. And you're going to say, yeah. You got 20? $20 million? No, you don't. Don't lie. I mean, okay, on Tinder you can't, but you have to. God knows I'm going to hell. No. Anyway, the thing, though, is that you're probably not going to do this. You would probably want to go to an underwriter, an investment banker, which is what I'm going to take you, who are going with us up to Chicago. This is what they do, is they will. I'm an investment banker. You come to me and I say, okay, we're going to work this out, and then what I will do is I will buy your paper. In other words, I will lend you this $20 million minus fees. And then what I will do is I will sell it to my clients, break it up into chunks that they can handle, and maybe I'll have some other members of the syndicate, they'll sell it to their clients, some of it. And that's how you'll raise the money. So in other words, the primary market transaction is just you to me. And then we go out in the secondary and sell it. It's just like stock. You're probably never in your life going to be in a primary market transaction of any kind, because that is between the company and an investment banker or an investment banking syndicate, okay? So we get it out there. So you come in, oh boy, I get my $20 million today, and I said, not so fast. We need to talk, because we have to create a contract. What are the terms of this loan agreement? Now, you see, when you go in for a loan at a bank, you, sir, decide, I should like to buy myself a Tesla. So I'm going to go to the bank, and I will negotiate the terms. No, you won't. We will tell you who's your daddy. With these kinds of firms, depending upon, we will work with you to get everything right. However, the contract is standardized, and it's just a matter of moving a few things to the right numbers. For example, what will be the coupon that you pay? That will be based upon the risk of your corporation. That will be, in other words, what do the bond rating agencies say? AA, AAA, BAA, something like that. And I'll show you that on Monday. We'll figure that out. We'll also figure out how long you want it for. In other words, first we'll need to know the coupon, then we'll need to know the time to maturity. Are we talking about it's 2019? Do you want this to last 20 years, 30 years, 15 years, 10 years? We work that out. We work out other things, too, in that bond agreement. This agreement that we are working out is called the indenture. The indenture. This is the core, and it... Funniest thing was that I had been doing consulting for a number of years, and I had never actually seen the indenture itself, the actual paper. And I finally asked someone I knew in an investment banking firm, can you give me show me an example or send me an example? And he didn't, but he said, well, you're going to be up here next month. So he had one that was in process. Son of a dog was this thick. I mean, just all these here fors, what to, who farted, all this stuff, right there in the agreement. It's all in there. And, of course, that goes to something you probably learned in your law class, the Four Corners Doctrine. If it ain't in the written agreement, it ain't part of the contract. There's nothing else. So everything you want, if you're going to have a written as opposed to an oral agreement, then it has to all be in there. Okay, so the indenture. Now, one thing that's going to go on in there, is this going to be a collateralized debt or an uncollateralized debt? If it's going to be a collateralized debt, there will be a second document, which is the mortgage agreement. This lays out the asset that is backing it. If it is not a mortgage bond, then it is an indenture. A debenture. Now, interestingly enough, someday, madam, you will own a home. It'll be a double wide house trailer on the outskirts of Decatur. Okay, ma'am? Now, understand what that means. No, you're not getting a mortgage. I'm going to the bank to get a mortgage. No, you're not. You're going to go to the bank to get a loan, a promissory contract, an indenture. Now, by necessity with home loans, you will have this mortgage agreement attached to the indenture. So you're going to get a loan. You're going to get an indenture, a promissory agreement, a promissory bond, promissory note, whatever. And attached to that will be, in your case with a home or a car or something like that, will be this side part that is connected to it called the mortgage. So kind of keep that in mind, that there really is a difference. You're not going to get a mortgage. You're going to get an indenture that will have a mortgage attached to it. Now, with corporate, it doesn't necessarily have to be a mortgage. Now, you'll get a lower coupon if there's a mortgage attached. If it's a mortgage bond, because there's more safety. If your company goes belly up, my investors will be able to liquidate that, whatever it was, a building, a factory, a fleet of trucks, something like that. But it doesn't have to be. There are a lot of papers, debenture. And, of course, it'll carry a slightly higher or a higher interest rate just because it doesn't have anything physical backing it. So in other words, I'm trying to think. A home loan would be a mortgage agreement on an indenture. A credit card is a debenture because it's not attached to anything. Now, by the way, I learned this when I was doing oil and gas consulting, and then I got into the business myself for a time, is that there are some things that are technically mortgage agreements that aren't called that. To give you an example, I worked with and then I became one of a group of wildcatters in Texas. And, I mean, we punched hole after hole and it was just like nothing. But then every now and then we'd punch and we'd get something. It wasn't anything, you know, those shows where the oil's spraying up. Wah! Nah, it came out of the ground and it was hot and it stunk like hell and it was sludge and there wasn't a lot of it. But it was not a dry hole. So what we would do is if that happened, and we would, the financing guy would call this bank in Houston and say, okay, we got to set up an ETC here because we'd have to put up the pump jack, we'd have to get the reserve tanks in there and the piping and all that kind of stuff. What he meant by an ETC was basically it was a loan that on equipment. We were buying equipment, we borrowed to get it, and it was the borrowing was backed by the equipment itself. It was called an ETC, an equipment trust certificate, but it was a classic indenture with a mortgage on it. So it was basically a mortgage bond, except it was shorter term. You know, these wells might pull for, if we were lucky, a few years. But anyway, so moving on here. Okay, now, as far as bonds go, debt has prior claim on the cash flows of a corporation. Okay, that in itself means that the indenture agreement. The indenture agreement. The most important part, other than the parties thereto and addresses and address, name and address for service of process and blah, 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 is what are called the covenants. The covenants. Those include, of course, what the percentage is that you're going to pay the coupon, how long it is. You're also going to have in there, remember, that when you borrow this money, like Netflix borrowed $1.2 billion for 15 years, it does all it pays is the interest for 15 years. Only 15 years after issue does it have to pay the $1.2 billion back. Well, the covenants are going to say, you're going to be putting money into an account to make sure that by year, let's say 10, you've got enough money to pay the face value of that debt off. Now, they call those sinking funds. They showed you sinking funds in your accounting class, did they or not? Do you remember that term in your accounting classes? Is essentially, it's just like, the company has to put a certain amount of money into this safe account they can't touch every year so that there is plenty of money there to pay off the face value of the debt when it comes due in 15 years, 20 years, 30 years, or whatever. So that's one of those things that goes on in these kinds of, in the covenants, setting up. Now, there's another trick that is, it's not necessarily always with a sinking fund. There's another trick that you'll, well, there are a bunch of tricks. One thing that's kind of interesting, let's say that you, sir, want to borrow $10 million for, let's say, 15 years. We might set up something that is different from a sinking fund. Let's say that instead of you borrowing $10 million all at once, we lend you $2 million every year for 5 years so that then the money you owe is owed in $2 million installments over the 5 years starting in year 11. That is sort of like a sinking fund in itself. You're probably going to still have to put some money into the bank to cover the $2 million. But it creates kind of the effect of a sinking fund. Those are called serial bonds. Serial bonds. And no, that's not C-E-R-E-A-L. That's S-E-A-S-E-R-I-A-L, serial bonds. Okay, now, here's an important, very important part of the covenants. There's going to be a trustee appointed by the lenders, by the investors. This is going to be a person, actually a company, possibly an accounting firm, a financial consulting firm, something like that, a law firm, that will oversee performance by the company. The trustee will make sure that the company doesn't do things that would put the lenders at risk. You see, the company is going to want to do things that are in the interest of shareholders. Sometimes those things are not in the interest of the bondholders or the debt holders. So, for example, the trustee and the covenants may specify how much you can pay in dividends. Yes, we understand that we want a company that pays dividends. Investors like that. But you're not going to go crazy with your dividends. You're not going to pay the moon. You're not going to give special dividends, something like that. You're not going to have a growth rate of dividends that is excessive. We know that a growth rate is important to the stock price, but you can't let that growth rate get to the point where you are putting at risk what you owe us for every year. Because remember, we come first. The stockholders come last. You make a mistake, we are the ones first in line to pay the price for that mistake. Also, you will see that the trustee has oftentimes the power to say no to projects that you might want to do. Because the company wants to take on projects maybe that are high risk, because high risk means higher expected return to the shareholders. But as a bondholder, I don't give a rat's butt about that. You see, let's say that the coupon is 8%. You see, you could take on projects that pay 9%, 20%, heck, even 45%. Wow, the shareholders, if they're the right kind of shareholders, they're going to love it. But you see, I don't get any of that. I get my 8%, whatever you take on. So you can take on this kind of risk. That's wonderful for expected return to the shareholders, but it doesn't do anything for me. All you do is put yourself at greater risk of bankruptcy. And that's the problem for me. I don't like that. So I might say, no, you can't do these things that you want to do. You, ma'am, are Elon Musk. Try to make your eyes spin and pretend you're smoking a key of pot, okay? Yeah, you are. Wow, we're going to put 5-star hotels out beyond the planets. There are 5 stars. We're going to put these hotels on. Get it? 5 stars, 5 hotel. Whatever. Okay, the bottom line, though, is that wonderful. I'm a bondholder. You could drive this company into the ground. Well, he already is with Tesla. But, I don't want that. You need to do things that will keep this company alive and paying moi. I'm the bondholder. I am the mommy. What I say goes. That is why you'll have a trustee in there who is the no person for representing the lenders so that they can't do things that are in the interest of shareholders, but are adverse to my interest in just getting my lousy 8%. That's all I care about, is you doing enough good business that you can take care of that. Now, the next thing is, Another feature that you want to keep an eye on is, yeah, go ahead.
All right, I was just checking, covenant is like the power that they...
No, the covenants are the actual parts of the agreement that specify the things that can and can't be done. For or are supposed to. Like one of the covenants would say the coupon is. Another covenant would say the trustee is. Another covenant would say the term to maturity is. It goes through every possible part. It's like, have you ever, you're not old enough to get a loan, a home loan yet, right? When you do, you will go in there and you will actually see an indenture agreement. You're not going to negotiate. They'll just say, here it is, sign it. Of course, they'll go through it with you, and you're not going, because they're required to disclose everything, and you're just, can I just go home? But, you know, that's one of those. It says how much your interest is, what your monthly payments are, and all that kind of stuff, who we contact if there's a problem. That would be the agent for service of process. All those kinds of things are in there. Yeah, that's the actual parts of it. So, in other words, if you've ever seen a classic kind of contract, sort of a broad form contract, you'll start out with whereas, and they'll name the parties to the agreement, the addresses, and some other information. And then they'll drop into some definitions, and then they'll drop into the covenants. It was interesting because many, many years ago, the first attempts by the Congress of the United States to get businesses under control, specifically trying to stop monopolies, was in 1890 with, and I'll get into this later, you don't have to write this down, but it was with the Sherman Antitrust Act, which tried to set limits on how big companies could get. And it was kind of interesting because it was used successfully to stop John D. Rockefeller's Standard Oil of New Jersey. But the lawyers figured out very quickly that Congress had written this law without having these directions, without these explanations, without these clear statements at the beginning to guide courts in what they could and couldn't decide. So it didn't take long after the Sherman Antitrust Act was successfully used to stop John D. before lawyers for other monopolies figured this out. There are no instructions. There's no preamble. It just goes to the law itself, thou shalt not. And so they just turned it into Swiss cheese. They just shot it to hell in subsequent cases. So contracts more modern, whether they're government laws or whatever, or contracts, we do a great deal up front to explain everything before we get to the contract itself, the covenants themselves. I shouldn't say the contract, the covenants themselves. Interestingly, in 1917, Congress came around, and I show my students in economics classes, look at the structure of the Sherman Antitrust Act. It's just broad form. Here, thou shalt not. But when you go around to its amendment in 1917, the Clayton Act, my God, the first, you know, like 10 pages are definitions, and simply, here, courts of the United States, do not interpret it your way. This is the will of Congress. You interpret it this way. So you see that evolution very quickly. And in all agreements, corporate and professional agreements, called contracts, these days, we have all this preamble before we even get to the covenants. So that's why that thing that I told you about, that the first time I ever saw a bond indenture agreement, it was this big. And literally about a fourth of it was just explaining what was going to happen when we got to the covenants and defining the terms and all that. It's a little off the side. But now, okay. Taking this forward, there are different flavors of seniority in bonds. The highest bond... Yeah, go ahead.
So the example you had over here, that was your
serial
example?
No. That's just the serial is something. This is explaining why bondholders don't want the company taking on high-risk projects. All the bondholders want is to get their payments at 8%. They don't want companies taking on high-risk projects. Even though those would be good for the shareholders, maybe, they make it so that the company has more chance of collapsing, greater risk. So the bondholders are going to say, no, you don't get to choose your level of risk. We'll tell you how far you can push your speculation, your investments, your wonderful ideas before we start to crack down on you and say, that's not going to happen. That's what that's all about over there. Seniority. The top would be a senior debt instrument, a senior bond. Now, it could be a mortgage, which would be the very highest, or it could be a debenture. They would get their payments first. They would get their money back first in bankruptcy. And if it's a mortgage, they get to liquidate whatever it was that backed theirs, the asset that collateralized. And then below them, and there are so many levels of this. We could talk about the senior subordinated. They would get taken care of next. Then you have the junior. And I mean, there's so many, and then there's the junior subordinated. I mean, there's so many different flavors of this. Let me give you one real quick here. Suppose in a situation like this that the senior mortgage bonds, the seniors had lent the company, let's say, $10 million. And the debentures had lent the company $8 million. Then the senior subordinateds, they've lent the company $15 million. And then the juniors had lent the company $6 million. And then the junior subordinateds came in at $8 million. Now, obviously, as you go down, the coupon is going to be higher because there's greater risk to the lenders. Now, let's say that the company does go tap city. Hard assets liquidate at $15 million. Then the rest of the assets have a value of $18 million. So now, let's go through it and see what happens. Now, the seniors are going to liquidate that building, and they'll be paid their money, okay? So this 32, not right, $33 million, now is down to $23 million. Okay, so now we can go to the rest of them. $8 million is going to be hacked off here, so that leaves us with $15 million. And then $15 million is hacked off, and we're left with zero. So these two lose everything. Okay, that's why they will get a higher coupon rate, is because they're more at risk of losing, because when the company was liquidated, that's it. Now, notice something interesting here. A company that can't... Remember what I said. If you don't pay your bondholders, they have the prior claim. The stockholders, you don't give them a dividend, all they can do is cry. But those bondholders they will shoot your dog, sell your Bible on Craigslist, and make your parents wear furry costumes. I told you that, and that's really what will happen. They are going to shut this company down. They're going to say, no more of this crap. Now, interestingly enough, though, you see that there are two sets of bondholders there that probably would not want to do that. You see, this is where you can get into some interesting dynamics. And you, if you take my course 341 this fall, if you're into this stuff, you can see that this company actually has some negotiating room. It could work with those two sets of bondholders down there at the bottom and say, look, if we're killed off by the big dogs upstairs, you get nothing. But if you work with us, we and just make some kind of an arrangement. Instead of $6 million, we owe you $5 million. Instead of $8 million, we owe you $7 million, something like that. We have a chance of bringing this company through and surviving. Now, the ones at the top are going to say, no, 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 just liquidate it, kill it. We get our money. So what you have to do on the company side is see if you can pit the two groups against each other when they go to the bankruptcy court. And the big dogs, the senior subordinates, are going to say, well, end it, end it. But the lawyers, you might be able to get the lawyers for the lower tier to say, no, we want to give them a chance for a reorg. And we're working with them on a reorg. So you see that there is kind of a little bit of a play that you can make there. If you're in or near bankruptcy, you might be able to survive by playing one group of lenders against another to see if you can craft something that a court would say, yeah, we should kill you off, but this is a good plan. You've got to come back to life, and we've got some of your debt holders are being very agreeable to this, so they might give you a time to do a reorg. They'd obviously put you into receivership. The court would put a receivership trustee over you, but they might give you a chance to emerge from the bankruptcy. And then, of course, these guys upstairs are going to be bitching their heads off because they're just going to say, well, no, the company's just going to do worse and worse, drive itself into the ground. And, you know, it'll be a back and forth, but it could be a way to survive a bankruptcy filing. It's just something to think about. Now, one last interesting part of this is telling you about different kinds of bonds. Now, I told you about the serial bonds. I told you about the senior subordinate and all that. But in terms of groupings of bonds, you can have some bonds that are called a straight bond. It goes to the end of its life, pays the face value. That's it. We all go home. A twist on it is what's called a callable bond. Now, you might have an NFLX that is 6.8% due in 2033, but that might have a call provision, callable 2024 to 2028. This would mean that the company could pay off the debt, all of it, in that time frame, 2024 to 2028. It's a refi. Suppose that interest rates fall. Netflix doesn't want to pay 6.8% if it could reissue bonds at, let's say, 6%. Now, the investors are going to be really honked off about that, the lenders, because they were expecting to get 6.8% clear out to 2033. If Netflix calls in 2024, suddenly they're not going to get 6.8%. They're going to get whatever the prevailing is for that risk-adjusted investment. So that's a callable. So if a bond is callable, it's going to have a little higher premium on it just because of that risk of the call. Yeah. Sure. I almost forgot to say that. Thank you. A home loan is basically, almost all home loans are callable loans because you can always refi. Now, they're going to punish you with points and all that, especially if you call early. So an early call is not going to be a good idea. But yeah, you can always refi a home loan. So yeah, it's a classic example of a callable loan. That's good. Yeah, I can't believe I was going to walk right by that. Now, there's another one that's a nasty. It's called a convertible. Now, a convertible can be convertible at the discretion of the issuer or at the discretion of the debt holder. Here's the nasty one. a convertible bond that is convertible at the discretion of the company. Madam, I've got my coupon coming due to you. I have to pay it. I kind of can't pay it. So, you know, you're going to take me and you're going to shoot that dog of mine, which is okay. He bit me all the time. But you're going to steal my Bible and sell it on Craigslist. And then you're going to make my mom and dad wear those costumes. Okay, anyway. So, you see, but it's convertible. You know what I'm going to do to you? If it's a convertible bond, I'm going to take your debt that I owe you, and I'm going to turn it into stock and give it to you. I no longer owe you money because now you're a shareholder. You can't do anything to me. Meaner, that's a convertible bond. It turns the debt into equity. And then that shuts them up because the owners can't sue themselves. They're owners. They own the company, so they can't do anything. So you see, and when would you do that? When your company's in trouble. Which means, basically, I'm giving you crap. Stock of a company that couldn't even pay its bills. So you see why convertible bonds, they're going to carry pretty hefty coupons on them just because of that risk of the conversion. There are a couple other kinds of bonds, too. I mean, there are lots of different, there are all kinds of weird bonds. There are one kind of bond. It's called a foreign bond. Now, a foreign bond is a bond where the payments and the face value are paid in a currency other than the currency of the country. So, for example, you could have a country in West Africa that would not, no one would lend it money if the was paid back in that country's local currency. So they would denominate the coupon and the face value in, let's say, euros. And then the investors will come in and buy it. Another one, this is the one that I'm actually watching. It's very cool what's happening. Remember that a country cannot spend money in any country except where it got the money. So in other words, the People's Bank of China gets trillions of dollars in American money because we buy their imports. Okay? So they have to spend those trillions back here in the United States. But what happens if a country denominates its debt in American dollars? Enter Central American country, Panama. Panama is issuing massive debt in American dollars. And so the Chinese, the Russians, the Saudis are lending them scads of money because these countries have all these American dollars. They're really getting sick and tired of putting them back in the United States where we're a bunch of crazy, lazy assholes. And so countries like Panama are saying, we'll pay you back in dollars. And so money is just pouring in. A $775 million debt issue to rehab the city's slums. Probably about $1.2 billion, maybe not that much, but to make a new international airport. And then, of course, you have all those Panamanians take dollars every day. I thought I'd have to use Balboas. No, everyone takes dollars. They prefer them. Wendy's, some person who was cooking meat on the street, and I finally realized I had to look it up. That word they were using, I thought it meant meat. No, that was goat. So I didn't buy from that lady anymore. But anyway, they take money in dollars. They'll be happy to take the dollars because they need them to pay off their debts. So you see, foreign bonds are actually very cool. For a country that wants to attract capital, the country's currency is really dodgy. This is the way you can do it. Now I'm going to have you take this quiz, and then that's all I have for you.